Hello, and welcome to the fourth Bad Idea Podcast. We're your hosts, Simon Abrams.
And Steve Carlson.
And this month, we have elected to choose what has only recently become a very terrible idea. The films that we watch normally are actually pretty torturous to watch. And admittedly, there have been a couple this month's topic that were actually pretty hard to sit through. But for the most part, they've actually been pretty, you know, erring on the side of so bad it's good territory. So at least there's that to count on. Rather than keep you in suspense, the topic we've elected to do is in time for the release of Greg Mottola and Simon Pegg and Nick Frost's Paul. And the topic is E.T. knockoffs. And without even realizing it, the films that we picked have sort of been like a smorgasbord, a veritable cinematic smorgasbord from around the world. So basically, this is a podcast dedicated to E.T. ripoffs from
around the world.
Cue, it's a small world. And what better way?
Ripoff is the universal language.
Exactly. So I, what better way to start this than to talk about the American, the representative from American, Mac and Me. When was that made? 1980?
Mac and Me, I believe, is 1988, directed by Stephen Hillard, I want to say. A fella who I never would have guessed actually had a thriving career before and after the film.
This movie I actually found rather benign in its utter... How can I put this? Moral corruption. Because, like, honestly, like, there's nothing that this movie doesn't teach that isn't just, like, an extreme form of the same kind of promotion of junk culture that you see in a lot of kiddie crap of that day. You know, you get a lot of promotion of Coca-Cola, but in this case, and McDonald's, but in this case, they're promoted to the nth degree. Like, there's there are life-saving properties to Coca-Cola
yes,
that apparently
yes.
you don't know about, dear listener. And apparently that means that they're like that spoiler alert that one of these aliens at
spoiler for a 20-year-old movie that's terrible.
Yeah, and these aliens, which look like, by the way, sea monkeys, they one of them dies or is dying in a cave somewhere, and what the humans do when they rescue them naturally is give them a can of Coca-Cola. Instantly revives their spirits, and they are big bang boom, right back on track, and they can get off the planet and live happily ever after.
Hell yeah, it's the pause that refreshes.
Oh, dear God. But for the most part, like, the funny part about Mac and Me that I kind of liked is that in the beginning, the alien kind of seems like a really off-puttingly, like, nice serial killer.
I was gonna say, I have in my notes here, there's the one scene where
the drill through the wall?
The drill through the wall, yes.
Yeah.
It's basically Mac is a really polite, kid-friendly version of a giallo killer.
Yeah. It's really creepy, too, especially because these things, they do look like sea monkeys. They're anemic, they're claymation for the most part, although there are people in rubber suits.
There are people in rubber suits, and they move like they're drunk.
Yes, they waggle their heads back and forth from side to side, and it kind of reminds me of a bad Kylie Minogue dance move that never caught on. And it's very creepy, especially when early on there's like this really weird sense of humor that it's like, oh, let's watch the alien get the crap beat out of him by like all this foreign technology and social customs that he's not used to, like when he gets hit by that car and he's like spread across
yeah.
the windshield.
Yeah.
It's like if I were a kid.
And that's the thing, because he's hit by the car, lands on the windshield, and he stretches out, and he's got these big googly eyes. It's like a bobblehead got creamed across the window, and then he flies off, and then suddenly it's a huge horrible accident.
Now and. Which goes into the fact that for E.T., most E.T. knockoffs, you imagine he won't talk much based on the original. And this one doesn't. He just whistles like R2-D2.
Yes.
And it's just that much creepier because, like, he's splattered across this windshield, and it's supposed to be funny.
It's clearly intended as, like, a Looney Tunes rubber reality type thing.
But he's whistling the whole time. He's like... and he's like... What?
Yeah. The whole timbre of that scene kind of really sets it. It's a film made by people who are trying to consciously emulate the E.T. template.
Yes.
But what's bizarre about it is they can't seem to get it quite right.
Right.
Like, they understand that, you know, one of the reasons that E.T. was, you know, struck such a chord is because there's a real sense of danger in it. That, you know, Elliot gets sick over the course of the film. E.T. gets sick over the course of the film. There's a sense that there might be something wrong there, that something might go wrong. And then, you know, then the authorities come in and take E.T. away. And, you know, but, so they're trying to get that same sense of, you know, yeah, that same sense of menace without being too dangerous about it. But they completely fuck it up.
Right.
Like, they send, like, there's that infamous scene where they send the kid in a wheelchair. The protagonist is in a wheelchair, if you haven't seen this. And they send the kid rolling down a hill, flying off a cliff.
Into water.
Into a lake.
Yeah, and the best part about that is the kid tries to apply the brakes on this wheelchair.
and the brakes snap off.
He cannot apply the brakes. He is fucked. He's
going to die.
Yes, and the only thing that can save him is Mac. And this is my favorite part of the scene, is where this kid is like, he's on his back in the wheelchair, and it looks like he's gonna drown. He's flailing. He can't swim naturally. And Mac just like slithers underneath the surface, and the claymation in the scene is so horrid. Stop motion, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And it just looks so bad because he's like clearly like just underneath the surface of this, and he's just like going like, he's just like completely parallel to the water, and it's one of the most ridiculous effect scenes ever. Like if it weren't enough that they just sent some poor handicapped child down hurtling down a hill and off of a cliff.
Yeah, and
there's, you know, some manner of demented creature from the Black Lagoon that looks like he should be in Sally Struthers' boot camp.
And I do want to note that what makes the film even more kind of awe-inspiring in its way is that the kid who plays the lead actually is disabled.
Holy shit, balls. Yeah, are you kidding me?
He has spina bifida.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, it was his only major acting role, and they really basically sent a kid with spina bifida rolling down a hill.
Well, you gotta say, the main problem I have with, or actually, the one thing I do commend Mac and Me for, before I go on to say that it's kind of,
a piece of shit.
Boring compared to the films you watch, is at least, it has some kernel of intelligence to it. Like, for instance, the fact is that, like, the wheelchair scene can actually be justified on some level by basically saying, like, well, he doesn't know what he's doing, or the drill scene, like, yeah, he doesn't know what he's doing, like, this is just him playing. Like, that has more logic to it inherent in that kind of character motivation than something like Nuki from South Africa,
yeah, and which we'll get to.
Which is a much more entertaining, terrible film,
but it
has none of that level of thoughtfulness to it, which is actually kind of tragic, isn't it?
It's Nuki is a film where every decision that was made in the film was a bad one.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. But I think I enjoyed Mac and Me a lot more than you did, simply because the body of the film is just kind of base E.T., but there's just so many what-the-fuck curly cues rolling around in it.
Mm.
Like the thing about the scene where they're moving in. And the little girl from next door sees them.
Yes.
And she's standing across the street in an Indian headdress. And what's the first thing she says? I'm communing with the earth spirits! It means nothing. It's just a random little, have that! And, you know, there's just all sorts of weird shit just happening under the surface of this film. The breakdancing competition at a McDonald's with a dancing teddy bear.
Lot. Yeah, there's a breakdancing competition in the parking lot of this McDonald's. Like, portrayed as this amazing place for kids to be because, like, it's where the community apparently breakdances spontaneously in the parking lot. And you can have parties. You can have your children with the one and only Ronald McDonald.
He'll be there.
And he will promote such healthy living, signs of healthy living as Coca-Cola in the hands of every little boy and girl.
Yeah,
including the scene
yeah.
where Mac dressed up as a, what he said?
He's dressed up as a giant teddy bear.
Yeah,
and everyone believes he's just a toy.
His eyes peering out from that teddy bear outfit makes him look like the retarded guy from Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. And he's like, he's got his little stretchy arm reaching out to grab a can of Coca-Cola away from someone because he's gotta have that fucking Coca-Cola.
It's They even try to give an explanation for the Coca-Cola omnipresence in the film when the little girl remarks, he must have had something like this at home. Look at how he drinks it, or something to that. Something right. Like that. This must be the stuff he lives off at home. It's a really weak excuse, but actually the thing that. I mean, it's obviously a horribly commercialized film. And McDonald's and Coca-Cola apparently both had hands in bankrolling it. Which explains a lot. But the funny thing is, I think the bit that truly explains the commercial aspect behind it, it involves neither McDonald's nor Coca-Cola. It's in the scene where the kid's like looking at a picture in his lap. It's like right as they're unpacking him. He's in his room at night and he's looking at a picture. And I think his dad might be in the picture or something. I forget why he's looking at it, but it's a significant thing for him. And then he moves the picture and underneath his lap is a bag of Skittles for no reason. It's just there, because why not? Let's throw in a plug for Skittles.
Speaking of his googly eyes, though, this brings up this point that I was recently watching this video that Adam Zanzi booted up onto YouTube, where he was trying, and to my mind, he didn't quite use interview footage that Spielberg said to refute these assertions that Terry Gilliam and Salman Rushdie had about why E.T. and Close Encounters of the Third Kind are dissatisfying on some level. And Gilliam was saying about E.T. that basically it's too easy to like this character. That the eyes, the bulging eyes of the character, that these big doughy eyes, make it much too easy to make a character that is otherwise immediately repulsive, like the big anorexic gut.
But that's kind of the genius of E.T. in that it has this the perfect combination between the weird, creepy alien aspect and the adorable, lovable aspect. And we see that in all the films we're going to discuss, where they try to hit that, and they just can't get the balance right at all.
Well, I don't think in all the films we discuss, not the German E.T. Born.
Well, okay. I don't think it's supposed to be cute at all. But not so much.
Let's move on to Nuki, which I find the most satisfying of the bunch.
You can't leave out the climax of Mac and Me.
Go ahead.
I literally spent the last 15 minutes of this film speechless the aliens, after being revived, wander into a supermarket and start causing chaos, and the cops show up and they start opening fire on the aliens, and the kid happens to be standing there, and they make a gas station blow up and fill the kid full of friggin' lead.
Wait, was it a gas station? I thought they set the supermarket on fire.
No, there was a supermarket, and then there was a gas station across the street, and they wandered over to the gas station, and it erupted, and the kid's dead. And then, of course, the aliens get to resurrect him because, they're like E.T., but better, apparently. But the thing that blew my mind was the ending scene where, in all these other movies that ends with, the alien E.T. or Nuki or whomever going home, you're getting to go back to their world. Mac and Me so believes in its concept of American consumerism and, assimilation and corporatization, that it ends with the aliens being sworn in as citizens.
Yes. Yeah.
And driving away in a pink Cadillac.
And it's not only they're being sworn in as citizens, they're made to wear like these
ridiculous suits.
Dresses, and it's like, you just have to wonder, like, for characters that were just you're applying way too much logic by thinking this, but wouldn't they be more uncomfortable, like, wearing that crap? Like, do they even know what's going on?
It's clearly been demonstrated just from the supermarket scene that they have no idea how to integrate into American society.
Exactly.
They just cause destruction and chaos everywhere they go.
Right.
So let's make them citizens!
Yeah, really. They fit right in. On to Nuki.
Nuki.
Which is, as we mentioned earlier, a South African take on
the E.T. And it's quite legendary across the internet.
It should be, because, well, for one thing, the actor's performance, if they were just saying their lines aloud for the first time in any given scene, there's a bonanza of exposition in any given scene where, like, because there's a computer character named Eddie, and he's constantly telling us like, what, narrating every other scene, like, what's going on at the Space Foundation.
Oh, I love that. Space Foundation. Nothing to report.
Space Foundation. 12
nothing
o'clock.
To report.
Colonel Carl Weathers is administering the subject's annual colonoscopy. The subject is thoroughly enjoying it.
It's like, especially in this, like, they, I guess in the first half of the film, they had that narration and those establishing shots, and they were actually talking about stuff that they were doing to the alien. But they keep coming back to those in the second half, and every time it opens with nothing to report.
Yes.
It's so why?
Why do it? Yeah, exactly. Because that's the thing, like, I just find this movie to be utterly charming for how insane it is. It, like, it has no level of consistency whatsoever. Like, it just has these ideas. Like, it kind of reminds me of Barry Levinson's Toys in some way. Like, it just, like, has these jokes that it just, like, it has, like, a basic, very rough structure for, and the structure in Nuki is basically that they're twin brother aliens that look like very fucked up versions of the of, like, if you crossed E.T. with Babar the Elephant, you'd have what this guy looks like.
They look like a Care Bear that's been set on fire.
Oh, okay. And so, like, yeah, they've been separated. One lands in Africa, and presumably South Africa, and one of them lands in
America,
yes. All he knows.
And is picked up by an organization that is decidedly not NASA. It's the Space Foundation.
The Space Foundation.
Despite the fact that there are NASA logos across the vans.
Right. But yeah, he gets kidnapped by the Space Foundation, and they refuse to let him go. And Nuki, who is in South Africa, has to basically find his way from Africa to America, even though he has no idea what Africa or America is. And yeah. So, like, much of the movie is basically spent...
Take me to America!
Yeah, yeah. Do you know America? Nuki! Miko!
It's a film that has garnered a lot of hate. I mean, I think the reviewer of Something Awful compared it to being worse than getting AIDS from your dying friend as he bleeds out in your arms after you've killed him in an auto accident that also killed your girlfriend and your dog.
I remember that I like the fact that because I was watching this movie on YouTube in segments, because don't pirate your movies, kids. It's bad. Anyway, I was watching
it. It'll curve your spine.
Yeah, really. Mild scoliosis, guaranteed. My point is, the person who uploaded these videos, I can't recall any other instances where a person who uploaded a video encouraged you to downgrade it, like give it a thumbs down. Every video. If you hate the video, give it a thumbs down! It's like...
It's
he's off, dude.
Yeah, no, it's a uniquely exasperating and pointless and just completely... just terrible film, but for a certain sensibility, it's kind of weirdly entertaining that way.
Can we talk about Eddie the Computer now? Eddie the Computer.
You've been champing the bit to talk about Eddie.
Eddie the Computer sounds like Maurice LaMarche's Orson Welles impression, but as a computer. And
they're even better when you're a computer.
Oh my god. I forget. Well, there's this one line where he tells someone, and there's like this really weird sexual undercurrent through a lot of his interactions with things. Like, it just seems like it's one scene away from becoming like a really weird porn. Like, there's this one line where he asks, I forget what the context for this is, but he says, "Don't tell anyone." And I'm like, "Don't tell anyone? Gee, what kind of kids movie is this?"
You smell nice.
Yeah, yeah. He says, when he's discovering his feelings, he says, "You smell nice." And oh god, what is it? I got this.
Alright. I just have written here, the computer is in love!
Yeah. I can't remember the succeeding line, but at any moment I swear he's going to say something like, "It will be our little secret, just like our secret happy time with a Commodore 64.
During the scene where he confesses his love to the lady scientist, I kept expecting it to suddenly do a horrid right turn and turn into demon seed or
yes,
something.
Yes, exactly. Like, or the scene where he's helping one of the head of the Space Foundation, like the hard-ass leader of the group that's always, like, pushing them to, yeah. to test the alien that they've captured with more drugs.
Which they don't know if it's animal, vegetable, or mineral, even though it clearly has a pulse.
Yeah, really. And Eddie, like, at one point when that evil Space Foundation guy walks in, he says, "Why don't you come in? Welcome to Miko and Eddie Circus, ha ha ha." when this human character just walks in and starts to take his jacket off, I really got worried. I was gonna be honest. Thankfully, he's just forced to regress to the point where he thinks he's a clown, because that's totally normal to just have a computer that has some kind of hypnotic powers. Wait.
Oh, he's totally got hypnotic powers.
He does. What's it called? It's called like there's a system to it. It's called a. The auto hypnotic defense program. Yes, Eddie has the auto hypnotic defense program, and I love the part where there's so many good parts with Eddie.
He uses it on Miko,
whatever that is.
He uses it on Miko, and so then Miko teaches him about feelings, even though there's no consistency on what the computer does and doesn't know. But the amazing part about that scene is just the entire setup requires that this alien, who the government is testing in many myriad various ways, and is not being guarded at all.
Yeah, really.
It's being guarded by one dude with a television monitor in his office that he never looks at.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the best part is, like, when this guy is gone...
And then when the alien escapes, does it leave? No, it just sits and has a conversation with the computer.
Right. That's what. Yeah, a lot of this movie is very rudderless. There's, like, not a lot of, like, actual decisive action going on. Nuki in Africa is actually figuring out, just, like, he's just talking to different animals. There's, like, a chimp... named Charlie. That likes candy a lot.
And he always wants to offer him candy.
He sounds like Gilbert Gottfried, except high. And, like, there's, like, these two enthusiastic South African brothers that, like, help him out.
Tiki and Taki or something like that.
Tiki and Taki, because that's not racist at all.
It's Tiki and Tuku, I think, because it's meant to be a deliberate reflection of Nuki and Miko.
Right. And, oh my god, back to Eddie.
Can't stop talking about Eddie,
Come on, where he tells the boss at the end, the boss says, "What am I supposed to do now?" And Eddie's like,
be a clown.
And Dr. Rhinestone, who's now the head of research after her boss leaves, says, "Maybe he's right." And of course he replies, "Maybe he is."
Maybe.
Thanks, Eddie.
It's like you expect an 80s montage music to be played there, like the theme song to like Perfect Strangers or something.
Yeah, because this computer just totally helped this uptight scientist find his real calling, being a clown. And he did it all using the auto-hypnosis. I can't even say it.
It's all right. But I think, concentrating on Eddie here, I think you're kind of downplaying how horrifying a lot of this is. Just because of the design of the Nuki puppet and his completely horrible interactions with everyone he touches. Like, he's determined to prove that he's not a bad god to the African natives, which, you know, hey, awesome. But if you were, say, an alien with powers and you wanted to prove you weren't a bad god, what would you do? Would you knock over all the pots in the village? Or, you know, send a motorcycle roaring around destroying shit? Would you do that? Because that's what Nuki does.
Yeah, it's kind of talking out of both sides of his mouth, admittedly. But the fact is, like...
And his nose is always running. I don't know why
he's
they did...
crying all the time, though. And this is why...
And it's horrible!
E.T. never talked. Or when he talked in fragments and not very much. Because nobody wants to hear this character talk.
Nuki, and all he does is talk.
All Nuki does is yell out, "Miko!" And it's like...
Do you know how to get to America?
No. He doesn't even say that. He says, "Do you know America?
Do you know America?"
And it's just... It gets...
Well, then there's the scene where the brothers are talking to him after they've been cast out of the village for letting a bad god in. And, you know, they talk about their ancestors being from the stars, and Nuki just casually destroys their entire belief system. It's like, "I'm from the stars. Your ancestors aren't up there." And then he decides, "Oh, but wait, now you need to go to sleep. So, fireworks show!
Oh, yeah, the dance scene. Yeah, he says he tries to lull these kids to sleep by saying, I'll help you go to sleep. And then he starts doing this weird little dance where he starts shimming his hips. And then suddenly, he, like, starts moving his hands up in the air.
And fireworks. Badly superimposed fireworks everywhere. And then he hits them with gas and they go to sleep. And he doesn't rape them. Honest.
Exactly. There's so many moments where I fear for these children's safety. Or even that guy's safety during the Be a Clown scene.
Yes.
Because, frankly, when you start disrobing under hypnosis, anything could happen.
Anything is about to happen.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of like Nuki, because it's so bad, it's great.
It's terrible, terrible, terrible film, but it's so incompetent that it kind of transcends and becomes almost like a holy object.
And
you can't forget the what the fuck ending, where like they hit the wall and you know Nuki's dead and the boy's alone in America, and then suddenly they throw their hands up. Oh wait, we can't end our film that way, and everything's okay suddenly. Like they throw in some bullshit about if you wish it can come true, anything you wish can come true if you believe in it. But they just realized, wait a minute, we just wrote ourselves into a corner. Fuck!
Yeah. And they just end, basically.
Yeah. Oh, and we can't forget the entire plot hinges on the fact that Nuki is in Africa and can't get to America. But he can turn into a ball of light and fly.
Yeah.
He could have done that at any time.
Well, that's the thing.
Including the time when he tried to hijack a helicopter.
Yeah, that scene at the end where he's like actually does fly over. The footage that he's using is just basically a reverse image of the footage we see of him crash landing.
Yes.
So basically it just looks like he's going back to where he started. I'm like, he's not even over water. Like, this doesn't
work.
Like, if I were a kid, I'm like, hey, I just saw this, guys. Give me a little credit.
But that's the thing is, the film doesn't give a shit. It can't afford to. And it's kind of weirdly endearing that way. And it's just its failure is so complete and total.
Right.
And yet it's so harmless. It doesn't, it's, you know, I mean, I see a lot of bad movies. You see a lot of bad movies. And
yeah.
But this one, it's like, I couldn't even bothered to hate it, because it's just so, there's nothing malicious about it. At bottom, it just wants to, you know, entertain your kids for a little. And, you know, nothing wrong with that.
Right.
And, another film that we saw for this.
The Tiny Terrestrial.
Yeah.
From the Philippines.
I can't exactly say this one's non-malicious. I don't know.
Its intentions are hard to guess, honestly, because there's a lot of... we were talking about how Nuki had, like, it seemed to, like, have unintentional sexual overtones. This one has intentional sexual
overtones.
I guess the way that you could chart, the way that we programmed this, or we've scheduled this podcast, is how sexual do these E.T. knockoffs get? We go from the perfectly chased Mac and me to the German E.T. porn, whose name I can't honestly...
You don't have to pronounce it. No one knows its real name.
Anyway, I mean, this is the German E.T. porn.
Yeah, it is.
And the Tiny Terrestrial is on the oversex spectrum of E.T. knockoffs, because
there's a long sequence of the film where the Tiny Terrestrial is clearly meant as a penile metaphor.
Yes, because T.T., Tiny Terrestrial,
Instead of E.T. for extraterrestrial, and the film is ballsy enough to point out its own ripping off tendencies.
Yes, but I think they only did that to make that joke, though, because T.T.
Tagalog, I believe.
Tagalog, yes.
Yes.
TT is slang for penis.
Apparently, yeah.
So the fact that he's also, the other nickname for this alien is Little Boy Blue, is another reference to the fact that this character is named after a penis. So these two boys that find him
walking around talking about their Little Boy Blue.
Yeah, and their TT.
Yeah.
And the fact that they can't show their sister their TT because, well, you figure it out.
And Grandma can't know about their TT.
Yes,
I mean,
no.
Grandma can't know about Little Boy Blue.
Yes, no. It's
especially because Grandma's religious.
Yeah. But that's one of the things. Like, there is a point in that movie where it's nothing but bad puns. And, like, we were talking about it. Like, that movie doesn't really have a point.
It's if you can imagine it, it's even more rudderless than Nuki.
Yeah.
At least Nuki has a semblance of a plot.
Yeah.
Tiny Terrestrial is apparently... about a large blue blob that looks like Yoda fucked a,
Kirby.
Yeah, thank you. And it fell in some blue dye.
Yeah.
Comes to Earth. We don't know why. It walks around.
It shrieks like a howler monkey.
All the time.
Yeah.
And then it gets kidnapped, and then it goes home.
And the one sign that you know that this movie is not right in the head is the fact that, like, in any normal comedy, you would have, like, one or two comic relief characters or, you know, children's film, whatever type of film. Mm. There's, like, a couple of characters that you know sole existence is to provide comic relief. And there's, like, at least four or five comic relief characters in this film. There's some weird flamboyant gay guy on a bridge that
shows up for one scene.
Yeah, and he gets rescued on what we jokingly call the bridge on the River Kwai after T.T., shrieking for a few seconds, uses his pink laser tractor beam to pull him out of the water and back onto the bridge.
And let me just point out that this is the only time that T.T. uses this little force of his. Even though there are several points in the end of the film where it certainly would have helped.
Yeah, so there's that character, there's the scientist character that's like...
And to be fair, the movie makes the Bridge on the River Kwai joke first. And I was kind of surprised by that because the intended audience wouldn't get that joke. It's aimed at kids. And so, what?
I think you're giving this movie way too credit. I don't think they even know what the Bridge on the River Kwai is.
No, they totally made that joke. Mm. It was in the subs, man.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the other comic relief characters include, like, Dr. Edison Galileo, who's this crazy guy that is, he's actually crazy. Like, he's lost his marbles, and he has this crazy theory that the Atlanteans exist, and that the aliens that somehow related to Plato, and that the existence of this alien proves that Atlanteans come from inner space, and that that's where this alien came from. Which explains absolutely nothing. Another common character, relief character comes, the guy that's constantly trying to drag him out of the office that Galileo's always bursting into.
Yeah.
So, like, a great Galileo line, though, is where a scientist is explaining to us that he did have a mental breakdown at one point, and he says, why do you want to you wanna lose the few remaining marbles that you have left in your head? And Galileo responds, I'm not insane, I am God!
Because, you know, insane people don't, you never claim that they're God.
Yeah, sociopaths are usually very sane.
And there's also the guy who, half of the film, walks in because he's gotten out of prison.
Yes.
Yeah, and he ends up having absolutely no bearing on the story at all. He's just there to eat up more time and occasionally think that he's seen the alien. And first time he sees it, like, it's walking past a window, and he's like, oh, I've been away so long, blue people must be in now. I wonder how I would look if I was painted blue.
Yeah, and he has...
And then that segues into him randomly composing a cigarette jingle by singing the blues. A cigarette jingle about how cigarettes will kill you.
Yes, and cancer is their brand. Just one whiff and you will forever go to sleep.
It's like everyone showed up to film a kid's birthday party and a movie broke out or something.
Yeah, really. It's like, yeah, these characters all think they're hilarious, and their jokes are actually so terrible that they're pretty funny. Like, this movie is the kind of movie that ends on a freeze frame of a midget that just, the midget says,
I'm an extra in this movie.
And then he just, like, has this really goofy grin. And then the credits roll over his face. And it's like, what?
It's a movie that nobody really knew why they were making it. So they just threw a bunch of shit in front of a camera and hoped it would cohere into something.
Including the myriad times where they just rip off the Back to the Future main theme. Like, not even, like, when I say rip off, I guess that gives it more credit, because that implies that they, like, maybe, like, added some elements of their
own. A rip-off is Alan Silvestri's score for Mac and Me, where he's clearly riffing on John Williams.
Yes.
This is straight-up lifting. They literally took the Back to the Future score and parts of the Star Wars score later in the film and just dumped it right over their scenes.
Right.
Just pasted it right over, like, oh, gotta have something there.
Yeah, really. So, yeah, that movie... It's like, if we're going to chart the four films that we're going to be talking about, that one is enjoyable in its stupidity and craziness, but it's not quite Nuki level of enjoyability.
I wouldn't even put it at Mac and Me, man. It's... I don't even know what to make of it.
I enjoy the Tiny Terrestrial more than Mac and Me. I gotta be honest.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. It's just so.
And I think that leads us into the E.T. porn from Germany, which, well, what can you say about an E.T. porn from Germany that doesn't really feature E.T. fucking much of anything? This E.T. in this film is descending on Earth to observe the customs of Victorian era. Are they English people that happen to speak Germans, or are they actually supposed to be Victorian era Germans?
I have no fucking idea.
Yeah,
I think you're thinking about it a lot more than
they did. Yeah. So, yeah, they're all dressed in period costume for some reason, and they all like fucking each other very much, which, I guess you're Victorian, I guess you're entitled. And the thing about this is, okay, it's an E.T. porn set in Victorian era, blah, blah, blah. And why isn't E.T. doing any fucking? E.T. is apparently a voyeur, if this film is to be believed. The E.T. in this film looks like a cross between Pumpkinhead and, like if Pumpkinhead, like, had, like, a Lycra cat suit on that looks like an oil slick, you know, Joseph's Amazing Technicolor Lycra cat suit, for instance, you would have, you're very close to what this woman is wearing. There's, like, a slit where her vagina is, and there are, like, holes, garbage bag, like, cut holes where her areolas are. And this alien is barely in the film. It's just a lot of really cheap period dressed German people having sex.
And occasionally they'll cut to this chick in this horrifying E.T. costume.
And she's always in the doorway, and she's masturbating for most of the movie in the doorway because she's exploring. She's perpetually in this exploratory stage where she's figuring out, oh, hey, touching myself and being fucked by other people is actually entertaining.
Yeah.
Which automatically puts this on a more propulsive narrative level than Super Hornio Brothers, which, if you haven't listened to podcast number 2, is featured rather prominently in it.
I was kind of scared that Buck Adams would pop up in this movie, though. I just figured that'd be the kind of thing he would do, just to fuck up my day.
Yeah, really?
But, no, it's... Yeah,
you thought you could get away with no Buck Adams, Steve?
No!
You can't get away from me!
But, yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of the problem with the film, in that, you know, you download it, or, you know, you find an E.T. porno.
Right.
You expect it to have E.T. porno.
And admittedly,
but the thing is, there are parts of the scenes in which the E.T. character interacts with the other humans.
Yes, but sexually
interacts.
Yes.
But you can tell that none of the people involved were really thrilled about having that E.T. design near their genitals.
Yes, especially the actress in that suit.
Oh, no. No, she looked like she was having a pretty poor time of it. But it's like there's in the scene where she discovers lesbianism, like she's trying to get her finger near the, you know, the woman's vagina. But and she, the blonde woman in the scene keeps pulling away, like, you know, I can take care of this shit myself. You know?
I can finish myself off. I'm fine.
I don't need your skanky black and green fucking leather mossy finger near me.
Yeah, really. And that's the thing. Like, I jokingly made this metaphor earlier because there's a lot of really just like improvisatory jazz score throughout this film.
It's like someone tried to do the typical wah-wah porno score, but with a piano.
Yes.
And without a music sheet.
And harpsichord during interlude scenes. But still, the point is, during the scenes of sex, there are actual, like, Kenny G-level jazz musicians performing. And I was like, it's a metaphor for the movie's treatment of E.T. alien sex. Because, for the large part, it's just improvisatory. It's just the characters are figuring it out as it's going along. The E.T. character is just largely in these scenes. They're actually literally scenes where these two characters are... One, the guy is plowing the girl, and the E.T. character is just sort of like, what do I do here? I'm going to put my hand on the girl's butt while he sucks this guy off. And I'm not going to caress it, because that would imply that I know what I'm doing. I'm going to just, you know, touch it, put a couple fingers... You know,
in places and...
Yeah, not go too near the ass hole, because, you know, that implies some level of forethought. And, you know, it's a perfect metaphor for the film. It's all about the joys of... And the alienness! Ah! about sex.
Boom.
Bam.
Oh, you signed and sealed that one. Are we done with the ET porn? Can we talk about Nuki and some more, and maybe some more of the tiny terrestrial?
I don't think we can.
Because I don't really have anything else to say about the ET porn. It's kind of a tabula rasa thing. It is what it is.
I think we should just wrap up here, honestly. Although I think because we don't want to run as long as we did last time, there were other films that you should explore if you like this sort of thing. Like
there's a Turkish ET that's fairly notorious. There's an Indian film, Koi Mil Gaya,
yes,
which is actually pretty cool. I saw that last night and I enjoyed it quite a lot.
Yeah, I'd seen it years ago, but unfortunately I didn't have time to watch it. So I actually kind of recommend it too because it's by Bollywood standards. It's cheesy, but it's enjoyable to a point. It's certainly a sight better than the semi sequel Krish, which is a superhero movie. Totally ditches the alien angle, aside from the idea that the alien gives this character played by Hrithik Roshan superpowers. Mm-hmm. Other than that, the whole ET alien angle totally disappears in the sequel.
Okay. The scary thing is that the German ET porno is not even the only ET porno out there.
Dear God.
There's also a Brazilian one that I know of called Keep Up the Lust ET.
Why didn't we watch that?
Because it's Brazilian, and I imagine it'd probably be even more horrifying than the German one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think all the more... Anyway, whatever. This is plenty horrifying as it was. moving on. So, this week's Netflix grab bag, or this month's Netflix grab bag, good job, we asked you to choose from four titles, including...
Nine Deaths of the Ninja. Which I think only one of you voted for, which makes me very disappointed.
Yeah.
And Island Fury, nobody voted for, which makes me even more disappointed.
There's Love Affair, which is by the director of Sweet Movie and WR Mysteries of the Organism.
Yeah. Dusan Makhachev. I can still say it.
I am kowtowing to this man. Good job. And the one that you chose... by a rather large margin, actually, was Ernst Lubitsch's Love Affair. Love Parade. I'm sorry, I just read the same title twice. The Love Parade, yes. His first talkie film, and it was made in 1929. And it's actually, I think for the most part, Steve and I, in our discussion of this film, are going to inevitably have to talk about the problematic third act. But for the most part, I will have to say that before we do get into that, it's important to note that this movie, because of its, you know, when it was made, has, like, a level of experimentation and experiment, like, figuring out what it can do with the medium that I kind of find fascinating. Like, there are a couple gags that, like, are pointedly done to take advantage, to fully exploit, in other words, the medium's the new technology's possibilities. Like, there's a scene in the very first scene where a young I forgot his name right here.
Maurice Chevalier.
Yes, young Maurice Chevalier is seducing a woman, and her husband comes home.
This scene's great.
And it looks like the husband, in a jealous fit of rage, kills her.
Hmm.
And You only get that...
No, she kills herself.
Yeah, she kills herself, and, like, the sound of it makes you think, oh, that's a very definitive and final thing. She's fainted, and it signifies you, and, like, if you were to just... at a period where, admittedly, this isn't, like, one of the first talkie films. This is just Lubitsch's first talkie film. So it would still be shocking, but it probably wouldn't be that shocking. But still, like, when you hear that, you would automatically assume, especially for still kind of semi-impressionable viewers, that that is definitively the end. And the same thing when the husband turns the gun on Chevalier's character.
Chevalier, yeah.
And then you realize the gun didn't do anything. The gun is, you know...
It's loaded with blanks.
Yes, and...
And this is the great scene where Chevalier pulls open the drawer and throws the gun back in. There's a whole bunch of other guns there.
Yes.
Implying that this is something that this woman does on a regular basis.
Right. And another great is one of the first musical numbers in that film is...
But I just want to say, I think that whole scene is friggin' amazing in how it plays with both the idea of sound and how to tell stories in sound, even while not using sound, because the whole post-suicide, quote-unquote, thing is done silently, where they're figuring out what happened and, you know, how the gun works and why she did it. It's all information conveyed without a single word being, you know, being said.
Right.
And it's... And then there's the whole fourth wall breaking.
Yeah.
She's terribly jealous.
Oh, God, yeah. That's the thing. Like, I think that Lubitsch was amazing in terms of his comic timing. His comic timing is astounding. Which is why it's that much more disappointing that his dramatic timing, like, this movie is terribly bloated at 109 minutes. It's like, when you get to pacing the actual structure of the film's drama... It's so sluggish. It's insanely sluggish.
I actually think the film is terrific for about 2/3 of its running time. Right up until the marriage, I think it's world class. Hmm. And after that, I think it rolls downhill. And I admit it's for reasons which make sense when you consider the date, the year the film was made. But it just doesn't play quite as well these days. It's like I saw a Harold Lloyd film the other day, Feet First, and there's a whole sequence at the end where Harold's climbing by accident a skyscraper in a kind of a callback to Safety Last. But the thing is, there's a major part in this for Sleep and Eat, one of a black actor who got a lot of. Got a lot of work in the 30s and 40s and playing the stereotypical shuffling Negro type. And it's like, it's dated and it doesn't really work, but it kind of helps to look at the film from an anthropological perspective, I guess. And I guess the way that the third act of this shapes up kind of works in the same way.
Well, backtrack a moment. There's another...
But yeah, we'll jump back to that for a second.
There's another fantastic moment where they integrate the fact that this isn't just a talkie, this is a musical.
Yes.
One of the first musicals to exploit the medium, or at least one of the first musicals that wasn't just filming of a established musical review. Mm-hmm. It is one of the first, if not the first, I think, actual musical... designed, scripted originally for the cinematic medium.
Hmm.
And it's interesting in that way because there's this one number in the beginning that I absolutely love where Chevalier is being called back to his home country of Slovenia.
Yes.
And he's bidding adieu to Paris and all the women come to the window and he's singing about how much he wants Paris not to change, how wonderful it is. And his manservant does his iteration of that same theme. And so it's, different motif, the same motif, but in a different form. And then his dog joins in. And it's just all different, the way that you pan from one window to the next, to the next, to the dog.
To the dog. The dog gets a verse. It's great.
It's terrific.
It's pretty amazing, honestly.
Yeah.
And the film does, plays with a lot of conventions like that. Like, I like the whole bit at the beginning when we're first introduced to the country of Sylvania, where they're told, "Oh, the queen doesn't want you to march so noisily." So it's forward on tiptoes, march. And it's also a clear callback to silent film and how that something like that wouldn't be so noisy, but nowadays you kind of have to treat it like it is. But what I liked most about this was kind of the middle section with the interplay between Jeanette MacDonald and Maurice Chevalier. And the whole, the whole back and forth and how even, how it's kind of really surprisingly racy.
Well, it's pre-code.
It's very pre-code. I think it's pretty racy even by pre-code standards. I mean, it's
really.
The only thing that keeps these people from coming right out basically the only thing they don't do is come right out and say we'd like to fuck each other. But it's basically everything but it's just couched in very sophisticated and witty terms.
There's that one song number. I'm trying to think what it's called.
When MacDonald wakes up and right before she performs the Dream Lover number, they're talking about the dream she had. And it's like, well, it's not the sort of dream for a queen. I was like, she was dreaming about fucking.
Yeah, the promiscuity of it is definitely, while it is rather naive, it is definitely rather overt in much more than ways. If you like, if you were to look at Lubitsch's oeuvre, it's probably his most overtly. Well, I wouldn't say overtly sexual, but
you say Trouble in Paradise is pretty
flirtatiously sexual. Maybe, yeah. Was that before this?
No, I think it was 32.
Okay. Yeah, and this is 29, so... but yeah, I think it's interesting, because if you compare this movie to 1 Hour with You, which is... It's also
which I haven't seen yet.
It's also kind of racy. It's a much better movie in terms of the music, at least.
Okay.
And it also uses the Chevalier character's womanizing aspect character, or his nature, I should say.
I do want to say that I enjoy the music, but Jeanette McDonald was... I guess they were still trying to figure out the tech at that point.
Yeah.
Her voice was...
Very shrill.
Yeah, very... It's not just that it was shrill, it was that her enunciation was not being picked up by whatever recording equipment they were using. Like, I had to turn on the subtitles for a lot of her numbers, so...
Yeah, it's technically all around rather...
rough.
Simple. I mean, it's a three-camera setup, and I think that's why... the best numbers are the ones that are actually more reliant on what you can observe than what you can hear.
Like the Let's Be Common number?
Yes, absolutely. Song and dance team Lupino Lane, who plays Chevalier's manservant, and Lillian Roth, who plays Jeanette McDonald's maid, they make a great team, I think, and they have a really great sense of slapsticky timing in that number.
Yeah.
Plus, who doesn't love a good defenestration? I mean, that movie ends with him being, like, hurtled out of the window when he gets too fresh, basically.
Right.
The movie, like, as you were talking about, it's very racy, and the movie ends with the two characters reconciling and him winking at the camera as he closes the bedroom window, the curtains on bedroom window.
Oh, yeah. It's like, well, you know what we're doing. But, I also did like that number for, that number's interesting in that it's kind of the dividing line for the film. Both not just narratively, but also kind of thematically, and it also divides my interest in the film, honestly. Because the whole knockabout physicality ties back into the very, you know, the earthy, sexuality of it all. The very sort of open sexuality that's there without coming out and stating it.
Right.
But it's also clearly meant as a coming of the marital discord that's going to follow. The sort of violent emotional upheaval that's going to be a counterpoint to this physical knockdown dragout stuff that the entire song is saying that royal people can't do.
Right.
And, you know, they can't have that catharsis. And that, it kind of rolls into that, and that's kind of where the film loses me. And the third act is Chevalier moping around this place going, "Ooh, I have no power. I have nothing to do."
He's totally emasculated at this point. He's totally in the effeminate role, and that he has nothing to do after having married McDonald, who is the queen of Sylvania. He's not even the king of Sylvania by marrying her. He's Prince Consort. And basically that means he does nothing all day. He just basically waits to be given a pat on the head whenever she comes by. And... honestly, like, that leads up to a very problematic third act, because in that third act, he's just basically scorning her, and it gets to the point where another interesting use of sound is where he's locked himself away and is threatened to pack and leave her, and he's singing on the other side of the wall. We can't see him, but we hear him singing while she's bawling her eyes out visibly in the bedroom.
Yes.
And... the contrast is actually kind of funny in a sadistic way, but, like, it's the duration of the scene and the fact that it goes on for so long, it really hammers home what I think was Lubitsch's original point. Like, having seen 1 Hour with You, which is a remake of The Marriage Circle, which is a silent that he did, that movie and 1 Hour with You and The Love Parade all basically have this one thematic through line, and that's marriage sucks. Like, it is a totally dehumanizing institution. It doesn't work in any conceptual way. It's an impossible formality, basically. And I think in that sense, there's a really hinky sort of insistence on rubbing in the viewer's face that look how terrible this could all become. Like, it gets to the point where he to make the marriage work and to just show you how much to gain some semblance of like put his own pants back on in the relationship, he like agrees to be seen with her at this royal opera, which if he doesn't attend,
the country will be bankrupt.
Yes, even though he comes up with an idea for how to come up with like a better way to raise the money on their own without relying on other countries'
but
aid.
It's poo-pooed because he's the prince consort and he's not supposed to
exactly
do these things.
And that doesn't work. But I think the fact is that like during that scene where he's like openly ogling the girls on stage, and like the Afghanistanian diplomat is actually like offering him better binoculars to ogle these girls on stage while she's like simpering, the McDonald character is simpering in the corner.
And the point of that scene is to show marital harmony so that they can get the loan that they need. And if they don't show this harmony, then, you know, word's gonna, you know, the Afghani guy's gonna spread it to some other country, as it's explained, and that country's gonna spread it to this country, and then it's gonna make it all the way back to America, and then the stock markets will fall because these two aren't having a good time together. And then they won't be able to get that loan.
Right. It's a cruel.
But the thing is, by openly ogling these girls on stage, and you know, clearly not being affectionate toward his wife, just smiling, and when she reaches over to take his hand at one point, he like shoos her away or something like that. He's kind of doing that anyway.
Right.
I mean, the movie doesn't really think about that, but
no, I think it does. I think it basically it drives. I think if anything, it's just too forceful and rubbing in our face as
it's too concentrated on the humiliation of the McDonald character to the betterment of the Chevalier character.
Well, I think in that point she's no longer a character. I think she's just a representative of the mentality of let's stay together for appearance's sake that Lubitsch despises. He wants to like totally just rub it in her face that like, look at this, you wanted to have this relationship that doesn't work, be shown off for the sheer formality of it, and it's like, well, that's the point of marriage. And unfortunately, in this scene, you see just how humorous it can be when someone like the impish Chevalier character basically says, "Well, you know what? If you want to be seen, sure. You know what? I'll be seen. But you know what? I won't be looking at you. I'll be looking at the girls on stage."
Yeah.
And so it's like it's a very mean-spirited joke on the whole idea of marriage as an act of presentation.
Yeah, it just struck me as kind of overly nasty. More so than it needed.
I can see why. I should say, but yeah. I guess we should transition to saying what next month's options are, because we have a couple of really good ones actually.
All right.
I mean, this time it was the Netflix grab bag. If you don't know, it is a feature that we do every month, where we pick either from Steve's Netflix instant queue, or his regular disc queue, or my instant or hard disc queues, four films at random. You vote to let us know which film you want us to see, and the four choices for next month are Ousmane Sembene's Black Girl, 1966. It's a 56-minute long film. Neither Steve nor I really are that well acquainted with Sembene's work, but
I know him by name. I've never seen anything of his.
Yeah,
I know Black Girl's supposed to be fairly seminal, so.
So that's certainly something that we could take a look into. Niagara, which is film noir from 1953 with Marilyn Monroe and Joseph Cotten, which for a time was actually one of her big things that she was known for before, you know, The Asphalt Jungle and things like that. Or was this after Asphalt Jungle? I forget.
I think it was after Asphalt Jungle.
You're right. Yeah, because that was in the 40s, wasn't it?
I think so. Early 50s anyway, but it's not important.
And there's also probably the wonkiest one of this batch, which is unfortunate, is Manhattan Project from 1986. It's got John Lithgow. Crazy!
John Lithgow! Yay!
And it's
sort of the kiddie sci-fi thing, right? I mean,
I think so. Yeah,
I imagine it's one of those things that's going to be familiar to a lot of people from the '80s as one of those films that played on TBS constantly or something. I think it has something to do with like kids who are like building a nuclear something. I don't know. There's nukes involved. I know that.
And John Lithgow. And the fourth option is Marin Aid, the director of everyone else's. The director of Everyone Else She did a film called Forest for the Trees from 2003. I've heard that it's not nearly as good as everyone else, but at the same time,
it's still supposed to be pretty excellent.
Yeah, the worst part, naysayers at least basically say that it's good, it's just not that good.
Yeah.
From what I heard. And honestly, I'm kind of curious because I found everyone else to be pretty strong stuff. I should probably rewatch it, actually.
Yeah, it's you and me both. I saw it at the New York Film Festival, and I remember really liking it, but I didn't get a chance to revisit it, and I kind of regret that. So
I was a bit stand. I found it a bit because there was such ecstatic response to it. I was a bit off put by the fact that I didn't immediately love it, and I think if I were to rewatch it, I would like it more. But still,
yeah.
In any case, for the Bad Idea podcast, we look forward to seeing you actually in 2 or 3 weeks this time.
Yeah, we're having to rush this one out because Simon is going to...
Cannes, baby! Yeah.
Yeah!
I'm actually a lot more excited than I sound. I get all my my excitement out on Twitter and Facebook because that's what Twitter's for.
little 140 bursts of... Yeah!
Yeah, basically. So,
There is no bemusement or ennui on Twitter.
Oh, no, none at all.
It's either best day ever or worst day ever.
Well, why not? That's the thing, because it's like, my idea about Twitter and Facebook is that basically it's the very brief version of your blog. I use it that way.
It's your blog boiled down to its succinctest points.
And speaking of which, if you would be so kind, dear listener, do be sure to follow the Bad Idea Podcast at twitter.com/badideapodcast. We'll get updates from there, infrequent bad jokes.
Yes, most of the bad jokes.
But. And a couple of encouraging hints for you to either comment in the comment section of in any individual cast or to be sure to vote once, twice, multiple times if you want.
Three times a voter.
Oh, yeah. for the Netflix grab bag option because it's kind of like pulling teeth with you guys. What's with you?
Oh, they love us.
Yeah, all five of you. Anyway,
in case you didn't know, we're also on iTunes now.
Yes, and I hopefully find that it's probably a lot more user friendly for you. Do be sure to just let us know if the format, either on the In Review Online website or the iTunes, is one is better than the other. Sound quality is an issue. Just, you know, give us feedback. Give us feedback, you inconsiderate sons of bitches.
We love you. We want to hear from you.
Not when you neglect us.
You never call. You never write.
Okay, I think we should end there.
Before we turn off our listeners entirely.
Yeah. For the Bad Idea Podcast, I'm Sam Neighbors. And that's it. Steve just gave me a thumbs up. Bye-bye.